Welcome to a special edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, it is a tradition on the podcast that we close out each year by bidding farewell and celebrating in some sense or another the historical significance of some of the people who left us.
The listener may want to know, why aren't we not talking about health care or some of the other things in the news? And we will talk about that in future podcasts.
As we have indeed occasionally touched upon those subjects in past.
But this is a special, first of all, it's the last podcast of 2009. And we want to remember some of the giants, and or maybe some even lesser known giants, who passed away in the year of 2009.
Yes, perhaps even some Dodgers.
I think we should start with Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, died in August of brain cancer, the lion of the Senate, we always said. And yet, there was a time early in his career, in 1969, when we thought that his career would not go that far.
No words on my part can possibly express the terrible pain and suffering I feel over this tragic incident.
That, of course, is Edward Kennedy in July of 1969 apologizing to the nation and, of course, the state of Massachusetts for the Chappaquiddick incident, which resulted in the drowning death of Mary Jo Kopechne. His career, in a sense, never recovered, even though he did make a comeback in his later years as a giant of the Senate, as you say. He straightened out his personal life in his later years.
It
took decades, really. And the trajectory that had taken him from pretty much obscurity in his 20s, working for his brother's campaigns, to being the United States Senator from Massachusetts, starting in 1962, on to a moment when it was expected that he would pick up the torch, the fallen torch of his brother John and his brother Bobby, and be the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party sometime in the 1970s until Chappaquiddick.
And the irony is that the Democrats, even with Chappaquiddick in 1969, the Democrats sorely wanted him to run in 1972. He said no. They wanted him to run in 1976, and he said no. Ironically, the one time he ran for president was 1980 against a sitting Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. It was a tough fight. The odds were stacked against him. And yet, what I remember most about Ted Kennedy's 1980 campaign for the presidency was not so much the individual primaries, and there were many of them, they were up and down, but that magnificent speech in Madison Square Garden that summer.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
No, but that particular campaign most definitely came to an end that summer, 1980, and it, of course, contributed to the many ills of Jimmy Carter that led to the election of Ronald Reagan, and some people blamed Teddy Kennedy for that. So it was a long way back for him. But over the ensuing three decades, slowly, and certainly not in a steady upward trajectory, he did reclaim much of his personal legacy and much of his personal respect.
I think once he realized that he would not be president, he focused, unlike his two brothers, he focused on his Senate career, and he became, and not just because of longevity, and he was 47 years in the Senate, but he, with the passage of key, significant liberal legislation, he became one of the giants in the 20th century Senate.
Now, Teddy was the youngest of all the children of Joseph and Rose Kennedy, the legendary Cape Cod family. His sister, Eunice, also died this year, somewhat overshadowed, of course, by her famous brothers, but she was quite a contributor in her own right.
She died about 2 weeks before Teddy did. She was, of course, the wife of Sergeant Shriver. She also worked tirelessly for his kids, Special Olympics, and she was really, one of those unheralded Kennedy women. You always think of the Kennedys, you think of Bobby and Jack and Teddy, and yet there were so many women in the Kennedy family who worked behind the scenes. Eunice Shriver certainly was one of those women.
While we were losing two more of that particular generation of Kennedys, another figure from the 1960s whose name is familiar to everyone who was around for the Vietnam War and that entire era, Robert Strange McNamara.
Now, just in case the listener is not aware of this, Strange is actually his middle name, not an adjective that Ron Elving is adding. McNamara was John Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, stayed on through Lyndon Johnson, and through those years, for most of the Johnson administration and all of Kennedy, McNamara was the voice, the architect, the strategy behind the Vietnam War. The light at the end of the tunnel, all the success that they saw in the beginning, obviously by the time that McNamara finally did leave, I think it was in 68, the country knew that this was a disastrous war.
And he knew himself, and I think this is something that has been hard for a lot of people to deal with in the more recent years when McNamara has gone public with some of his thinking at that time. The idea that even as the war was pressed through the later Johnson years, 67, 68, McNamara himself had come to think it could not be won.
What I'm doing is thinking it through with hindsight. But you don't have hindsight available at the time. I'm very proud of my accomplishments. And I'm very sorry that in the process of accomplishing things, I've made errors.
That tape coming from a documentary made just a few years ago called Fog of War, featuring long interviews with Robert McNamara recalling the 1960s.
You know, of course, when you think of Robert McNamara, you automatically think of President Kennedy. When you think of President Jimmy Carter, one name I always think of is Jody Powell.
Jody Powell was the young man who started out with Jimmy Carter running for governor in 1966.
When he lost.
Lost that race, came back when he won subsequently and was his press secretary as governor of Georgia, and then joined the laughably long shot Jimmy Carter for president campaign, which began almost immediately thereafter in the mid-1970s, and then on into the White House for his one term as president.
That's right. Jimmy Carter was, of course, Jimmy who, but Jimmy Carter certainly knew who Jody Powell was. Jimmy Carter once said that Jody Powell knows me better than anybody else other than my wife. Jody Powell was there during the hostage crisis, during all the crises of the four-year Carter term. Jody Powell died this summer.
And in addition to Jody Powell, also the Attorney General from the Jimmy Carter years, Griffin Bell. Also, interestingly, in terms of how these things tend to happen, Herb Klein, who had been the communications director for Richard Nixon and served as a aide-de-camp to Richard Nixon through many of his campaigns in the 60s and 70s, also died this year, a journalist associated with the San Diego Union.
You know who also died? Bernard Barker. Speaking of Richard Nixon, Bernard Barker was one of the Watergate burglars. He also part of the conspiracy to break in to the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame.
While we're on the period of the 60s and 70s, Ken, one of the wives of the notorious segregationist governor of Alabama, George Wallace, left us in 2009.
It was Cornelia Wallace, who was George Wallace's second wife. Lurleen Wallace was his first wife, who succeeded him as governor, then died of cancer. The vision I always have of Cornelia Wallace is the assassination attempt of George Wallace in Laurel, Maryland of May of 1972 when he was shot by Arthur Bremer and he was lying on the floor. Cornelia Wallace laid on top of George Wallace to protect him from further harm. It's an image that has always stayed with me.
Also passing from the scene this year, the distinguished senior senator at one time from Rhode Island, Claiborne Pell, member of a patrician family from the Grand Newport families of old Rhode Island. Claiborne Pell spoke several languages fluently.
Not so much English.
He was notorious for being somewhat stumble-tongued as an English speaker, even for a United States senator. And yet he could speak to Ukrainians and French Canadians and all kinds of other ethnic groups who were present in the state of Rhode Island. And it helped keep him popular despite the fact that he was far more liberal than most of the Rhode Island voters.
Because Rhode Island was always socially conservative, very Catholic. And Claiborne Pell, very quirky, very eccentric, a six-term senator. He was briefly the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman, but he was always had this weird way about him. When the famous story, of course, when he's campaigning in this terrible weather and his shoes are getting ruined and he tells his aide to go out and get some rubbers for his feet and the guy runs out and gets them and brings it back. And so Claiborne Pell says, "And whom shall I thank for these rubbers?" And the guy says, "Well, I got them at Tom McCann's." So Claiborne Pell says, "Please thank Mr. McCann for me."
A wealthy man who probably had not shopped at a Tom McCann's himself.
He did not have the common touch, and yet they loved him in the state of Rhode Island. And actually, one of his big campaigns, when they thought he was in big trouble in 1972, he defeated Richard Nixon's choice, Richard Nixon's Secretary of the Navy.
John Chafee.
Who later became a U.S. Senator.
Yes, and of course, we should also mention, because many of the listener may have actually gone to college because of Claiborne Pell,
right.
He was the father of the Pell Grant.
The famous Pell Grants that enabled low and middle income students to attend college. But Claiborne Pell was not the only senator who died this year. Just a quick list. Paula Hawkins, the Republican from Florida.
Who was, in some respects, the Sarah Palin of her day. Certainly in Florida, she was. She was a transitional figure in emphasizing social conservatism in Florida politics in the 1970s, elected to the Senate in 1980.
Right, elected one term, lost to Bob Graham 6 years later. Also Jim Pearson, the liberal Republican from Kansas, Clifford Hansen of Wyoming, Henry Bellman of Oklahoma, all senators.
Powerful figure, Henry Bellman of Oklahoma.
Governor
was,
and
was really the father of the modern Republican Party in some respects in Oklahoma. But Ken, I think the listener is probably wondering why we haven't heard yet about Jack Kemp.
Jack Kemp was actually a fascinating figure and perhaps a more significant figure in electing Ronald Reagan than many people thought.
I agree.
Former NFL and AFL quarterback for the Buffalo Bills and the San Diego Chargers. Jack Kemp was elected to Congress in 1970. He's one of the fathers
1970, a long way before Ronald Reagan, a full decade before Ronald Reagan came to town. Here's what Jack Kemp used to say about why he left football for politics.
13 years in the NFL and AFL, I'd broken both ankles, both shoulders, my right knee, my right hand, and had 12 concussions. Nothing left to do but run for Congress.
Well, he certainly got his head handed to him when he ran for president in 1988. But as he was in Congress in the 1970s, he was one of the fathers of supply-side economics.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the leaders that preceded Ronald Reagan's election in 1980. Kemp didn't succeed in his bid in 1988.
Why is that, Ken? You know, a lot of people have been surprised by this. I mean, I remember when Newt Gingrich was a junior member in Congress begging Jack Kemp to run for president. There were just a lot of people who thought Jack Kemp was the natural inheritor of the spirit as well as the ideology of Ronald Reagan when he tried to succeed Reagan in 88.
There's several reasons. One of the reasons was that Ronald Reagan's vice president was also running for president in 1988, George H.W. Bush, and that was a big issue. Also, Jack Kemp was not the greatest campaigner. He was a bright guy, but I remember once...
Great on the stump as a speaker.
But I remember sitting in Iowa once, and he was talking about the gold standard to some farmers, and they said, what the heck is he talking about?
I think his downfall in many respects was his desire to be taken more seriously intellectually than the voters really cared to think about. They didn't really want to talk about the gold standard. He was always wanting to get into arguments about what was Keynesian economics and what was not Keynesian economics. It was as though he wanted to say, look, all right, I was a phys ed major and a jock in college, but I've really become quite the serious intellectual since. And he wanted to always tell people how much he knew.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I also think a lot had to do with timing. 1988 was not his best year. After George H.W. Bush's election, Kemp became housing secretary in the first Bush administration. But I thought the oddest thing of all was when Bob Dole picked Jack Kemp to be his running mate in 1996. Dole and Kemp never liked each other. They disagreed on almost every issue. We talk about how running mates don't like each other. We know how Kerry and Edwards didn't like each other. We certainly know about McCain and Palin, how much they may, or at least their stabs, didn't like each other. But clearly, Dole and Kemp never liked each other. It was almost a marriage of convenience. Dole desperately needed a reach out to the anti-tax wing of the Republican Party, and he thought Jack Kemp would give it to him. Ultimately, Dole Kemp lost badly to Clinton Gore.
And so that was a bit of a postscript to the previous frustrations of Kemp's career. Nonetheless, always one of the most charming figures in American politics over the decades. Even people who didn't agree with him on any issue always found Jack Kemp a fun guy to have around and an addition, if you will, to the vividness of the politics of the period.
And he was one of the few Republicans who argued for inclusion in the Republican Party. He always felt that reaching out to African Americans was the way to help the Republican Party, and not everybody agreed with that.
I'd like to pull a couple of names up here that might be, in some people's minds, obscure figures in American politics. John Markey, mayoral candidate.
People may not remember John Markey. He was a Republican state senator from Staten Island, served 50 years in the New York State Legislature. His claim to fame, 1969, he defeated John Lindsay in the GOP primary for mayor.
And he died in 2009. I can get more obscure, Ken. Don Yarbrough.
Don Yarbrough was a liberal in Texas fighting the conservatives led by John Connally in Texas. He lost to John Connally in 1962. He was threatened to run against Connally again in 1964. The Connally versus Yarbrough split in Texas politics is one of the reasons why John F. Kennedy came to Dallas in 1963.
November of 1963.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
The man who was reading that copy to the American people took off his glasses and needed a moment to compose himself before he addressed the American public again. And that was, of course, Walter Cronkite.
One of the most trusted people in America, certainly in American journalism. Walter Cronkite, a longtime anchor for CBS News, widely respected at a time when people respected journalists.
That's right, and was one of the reasons why people gave a tremendous amount of trust to the national networks in that era, was seen at the time by many conservatives as being a liberal figure. I think we came to learn later in his life, as he wrote books and gave lectures and spoke, that he did have political views of his own that he did not express on the air, and that that could have been seen as framing some of his journalism. Remember, he was the man who went on the air to say the Vietnam War was lost after the Tet Offensive in 1968. And he was also the man in the 1970s who gave an extraordinary amount of time, I believe an entire evening's broadcast, to explaining what was going on with the Watergate scandal and brought that onto the American consciousness in a way that no news story had done up to that time.
You know, there were other journalists who died in 2009, also with their own political bent. William Safire started out as a Richard Nixon speechwriter, the famous Nattering Nabobs of Negativism, which he penned for Vice President Agnew, later became a New York Times columnist. Robert Novak, whose claim to fame, infamous claim to fame, was the outing of Valerie Plame.
Yes, but who had been a serious journalist for decades and decades, a partner of Roland Evans. They wrote a column together. Robert Novak, whether you agreed with him or not, was known as a ferocious seeker of information and was as hard on many Republicans as he was on Democrats, although he was a proud conservative and especially an anti-tax conservative.
Certainly towards the end.
And another conservative, certainly the equal and superior in many people's minds of William Safire and Robert Novak, Irving Kristol. This is the father, of course, of Bill Kristol, the current journalist, editor of the Weekly Standard. In his day, Irving Kristol, who died this year at 89, was the editor of a number of publications, The Reporter, Commentary, The Public Interest, later The National Interest. He was known as a liberal in his earlier years, and then the father of the neoconservative movement, liberals who, in his own formulation, had been mugged by reality.
And you think of great journalist Jack Nelson of the Los Angeles Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his incredible work on civil rights when he was based out of Atlanta. One of the great investigative journalists of our time, Jack Nelson, died this year. And somebody who may have started as a conservative, wound up as perhaps an anti-conservative, but anyone who listened to the radio during the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, including the present time, always heard Paul Harvey on the radio.
And now you know the rest of the story.
And that's it for this year's Political Podcasts.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next year for It's All Politics from NPR.
Ron Elving and our listener, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Ken.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Smiling through, just like you always do.